a lot of bizarre ideas about the Bible, some rather negative ideas about it, and some people that use the Bible, as I said last week, like a Ouija board, you know, just pointing to verses in it and so forth. And people take verses out of context, get some simple thought that they hang on the wall that may or may not be true within the context of things. But they have lots of ways of using the Bible. In a large measure, I think the Bible is pretty much abused. I think that's why there's so much fragmentation, so many differences of opinion in the church over the Bible. It's abused because everybody that can read thinks that they're a teacher, you know. And they read the Bible and then they want to go out and teach it. But, you know, it's a pretty complex book. And to really get at the essence of the book requires a good deal of training, preparation. It's not that easy. Now, of course, anybody can read it. That's not the point. You can read it and enjoy it, and great many passages are quite clear. They don't have to have any special help. But when you get down to the nitty-gritty of some rather important things about the faith, as, for example, who is saved and who isn't, who's a Christian and who isn't, well, that's pretty crucial material. And you can't have amateurs playing around with it. You can cause so much discouragement, and the way a lot of it is taught, I would never even want to be part of Christianity. You know, I think it's narrow, petty, picayune, a lot of things about it. When you get it into sectarianism, you know, when you get a lot of little pet ideas that people coddle and play with, I mean, the church can become a great playpen with everybody playing around with their little pet ideas and theories. Everybody's got a theory about something, see? So when you get down to the serious issue of what is God trying to say to us, then you've got to do some pretty deep thinking and studying and reading. And the least you can do is to give the Bible, if you're going to teach it, the least you can do is give it the respect to assume that it needs to have some study. Not by amateurs. And the reason for that is not that God isn't able to give us revelation. If God wanted to, he could inject us with a hypodermic needle and fill us with the truth, but he doesn't do it that way. And the fact that he doesn't just willy-nilly hand out revelations is obvious, because everybody who says they have a revelation from God has a different idea. You get thousands of revelations coming across through the church, through various aspects of their facets of the church, and they've all got different ideas. I don't know who got his revelation and who didn't. That's what makes a joke out of it. Like one fairly important leader, whose name will be nameless, you know, claims he had a 7-hour chat with Jesus, and what he came up with for all of us poor peons was, "I want $240 from you because Jesus says you should give me $240." Well, you know, after he's had 7 hours conversation with the master of the universe, it seems a little bit déclassé that he comes up with the idea that he ought to give you $240. I think he could come to a little more magnanimous conclusions than that. But see, that kind of thing destroys the whole word revelation. I don't care who says it, they had a revelation from God. You're going to have to doubt it. I am. I'm a cynic. Now, if you can take the Bible and through careful study, through careful training, preparation, and so forth, you come to conclusions about the language as it is written, and you have some corroboration of it by large numbers of scholars who see the same thing, you have some basis of faith. That is, some basis that you're on the right track. And I've said to you before, there are a lot of major ideas that Christian people everywhere hold on to and agree with. It isn't all that subject to whimsical interpretation. For example, that God exists. The Bible is very clear about that. Nobody needs to doubt that. And that the God that exists is a an all-powerful, all-knowing, I suppose you could say, although even those expressions get a little difficult, because, for example, people who say God is all-powerful, and of course one of the typical little puzzlers that people bring up, can God do anything? And if you say yes, and they say, well, can God lie? And you say, well, no, he can't lie. And they say, well, then he can't do everything. Well, that's just silly. You know, God cannot do anything contrary to himself. We'll just put it that way. If you want to say that, not being all-powerful, then help yourself and say that. God has the capacity to handle the universe. I suppose he can do enough to satisfy our particular needs. But I don't like getting into theological traps like that, because it's just game playing. It has nothing to do with truth. But the Bible makes it very clear that God exists. The Bible makes it very clear that human beings have the opportunity of being in relationship to God, that he does communicate with us. That is, he makes himself known. And that's very obvious truth. And that salvation is a matter of the Spirit. The Bible is very clear on that, whereas the body may itself undergo a great many difficulties and maladies and so forth, that the Spirit is the thing that God really sustains in us. You have to believe something like that to remain sane in this world. You know, I mean, the Bible does support it, the idea, too. But it makes sense, because there's so many people in the world that have been dealt tragedies in their lives, and physical maladies and tragedies, whereas others seem to be get through life pretty well. You take the kind of person that lives till they're 80 or 90. I don't even know if I want to live that long, but some people do. They get to be 80 or 90, and they've never been sick a day in their life, etc., etc., etc. And some people come to the end of their life with fairly a good amount of money to sustain themselves with. There are people that go through life and don't have very much in the way of really serious trouble. Other people that just go from one tragedy to another. And a lot of that's just not something they deserve particularly. There's no indication that they're any worse than anybody else. Nor that they brought it on themselves necessarily. But things happen to people, happen to their bodies. We've been over to the hospital with Chris Morgan. You see, well, he's a poor little fellow, 15 years, at the age of 15, he's of course older now, but at the age of about 15, in an automobile accident. It was not his fault. He was not even driving, nor were the people that he was with doing anything particularly out of order. There was no indication there was any drinking or anything else. They just got involved in an accident. So he's a poor fellow paralyzed or in semi-comatose for a year or two. Now, what are you going to tell parents? You're going to walk in and say, oh, just trust Jesus, he'll be healed? Well, that's pretty presumptuous, and to say nothing of risky, because you just provoke a lot of disappointment, heartache, guilt, because, you know, if you try to tell people that the only reason the boy isn't well is because they don't have enough faith or something, you put a guilt trip on them that they don't deserve. On the other hand, it isn't really necessary that his body be whole for his spirit to be whole. See that? I can go there. And I mean, very personal here, but and maybe if Ginger were in the room, I might not. But I can go there, and I do about every week, and pray with him. Not in the sense that I'm assuming that my prayer can heal him, although I've prayed for some people in a comatose condition that have almost immediately come to, but not in this case. But I can pray with him with great sense of purpose, but that Christ has his spirit in hand, that his spirit is whole, and that Christ can, I pray for peace for him and for strength and grace and so forth. That's worthwhile. But now if I came there with the idea that if we all had enough faith, the boy would be healed. In the first place, there's no indication in Scripture that that's true. There were a lot of people in Scripture that didn't get healed. People in the Bible, not everybody got healed that accompanied with Jesus. In fact, if Jesus' mission was to heal and to make the world better, he failed. because there was only a limited number of people that he healed. Let's say that there were several thousand people in the course of Jesus' ministry that got healed. Yet out of a population of several hundred thousand, that isn't an all-star thing. You'd have to say, what about the poor ones that didn't get healed, you see? He didn't eliminate poverty from the earth. He didn't try to. In other words, the mission of Jesus was not to come and make the world a better place to live in. It almost was the opposite. That is, it was to make us better able to live in the world that is. Just a little sort of a light aside here. A young man came to a girl's father to see if he would permit her to marry him. They don't do that anymore, of course. Papa doesn't enter into it. But in the old days, if a fellow wanted to marry a girl, he had to go and ask the father about it. So the father said to the boy, or asked him, can you support my daughter in the manner to which she's accustomed? And he said, no, but I can accustom her to the manner in which I can support her. It isn't the business of God to make the world nice to live in, but to make us able to live in the world it is. Because the world it is a seething cauldron of tragedy and heartache and sorrow and evil of all kinds, and it is the consequence of a rupture between man and God, where disobedience entered the picture, and the consequences of that disobedience have been with us to the present time, and the earth, by and large, is sort of Satan's bailiwick. A lot of things happen on earth that you think God could stop if he wanted to, and I suppose you have to say that he could. Apparently, he lets it go because the thing he's trying to develop is a quality of a follower who can survive in this severe test. It's like the test that people have to go through, the physicals they have to pass, for example, and get into the fire department, the police department. They have to pass a physical. Well, it isn't quite that way. We're not trying to pass tests to see if we'll be in or not, but the glory of God is served by preserving the spirit in the midst of the circumstances of earth. That's the greater testimony. If God made everything lovely, all you'd have is a bunch of spoiled brats. That wouldn't be of any consequence. Like some young people are brought up in homes where they have everything. Nothing is denied them, and they can turn out to be spoiled brats. There are a lot of spoiled brat adults running around that never got over their being spoiled. Everything has to be their way. Some of us came up a different way, and I think we feel that we're better for it. We're better off to come up the hard way, as they say. I get a little tired of people that raise an outcry because education is going to cost them $100 a year more or something like that. I had to go through the whole thing alone and put myself through, and I didn't have help. Didn't have government loans or anything else. I just went out and worked and earned my way. Well, that doesn't make me any better than anybody else. It just means that I get a little unhappy with people that says because they have to pay an extra $100 aren't going to be able to continue in school. I think it's idiocy. It's good for a person to work. In fact, when I was teaching in graduate school for a while, teaching Greek, in fact, a student I had who was a graduate school, so you had to have an A, B, or B average to get in there from college, to get in the school. Well, one student I had had been a philosophy major at a university in the East. He was a very qualified fellow, but he was just not doing very well in his work. So I got together with him and asked him a little bit about what he was doing. And it turns out that his wife was working. I asked him how his schedule went. It's mostly in graduate school, you're timing, you're through by noon or something like that. And he used to go home, and his wife was working, putting him through, so he'd go home and eat his lunch, then he'd lie down and take a nap from his severe strain of the day, and he'd read the paper and wait and woke up something. But he never got to his schoolwork until after dinner at night. the poor fellow, he should have as I told him, I think you'd better go out and get yourself a job or something. It'd be a good thing to work all afternoon at least, and then study at night. But I used to, I worked full work schedule and also full school schedule, but I used to go to bed at 10 at night, and I'd get up at 1 in the morning and study till 4, and then sleep till 6, and get up and go back to school. See? So it costs you something to do that, but I think you're better for it. I'll tell you what, when I wake up in the middle of the night, I look at the clock, maybe it's 2 o'clock, I really feel good about it, because I think, great, I got a little more time to do something. So I may be a little bit weird. There are people that think that. especially my family, they all think of that. Unfortunately, I'm only home 2 or 3 nights a week, so it's good for them. But anyway, the point I'm making here is that if God went around doing in the world what we all think he ought to do, we'd all be a bunch of spoiled brats. But it's the fact that his spirit in us is able to sustain us in the midst of the tragedies of life that is to his glory. And tragedies do not have to take the form of some massive misfortune. You know, it's a funny thing about human nature. We can often bear up under the most severe trials and then fall apart over some, over losing an earring or something. That's just a typical thing, you know. Or a cake falling or a traffic jam or something. It's an interesting thing about that, and we're talking about the capacity to bear up in the issues of the world, the tragedies and problems of this world. And I was just saying that God doesn't come along and make everything nice for people, because otherwise we'd wind up a bunch of spoiled brats. The thing, but stress does not have to be only over major things, because we often can handle major things, and then we get just frenzied over some small thing. Can't find the right clothes to wear, or we lose an earring or a dollar bill or something, and we get a little upset by that. But we go through these things, see, and we survive. Now, an interesting thing about this survival is, in fact, we have to keep this very clearly in mind to survive well. And that is this distinction between the flesh and the spirit that I've often made to you. That is, you don't have to feel good about surviving. You don't have to survive rejoicingly. Some people seem to put that out, and in some circles, that if you're not shouting victory songs, you're not surviving. Well, I think it's the Bible doesn't say anything like that. You can cry if you want to. You can feel bad about things if you like. Doesn't matter. God is not going to fade away just because you feel disappointed and unhappy about something. You see, the reason being that God sustains our spirits. But you have to understand that the mind does not always handle things as well as the spirit does. Because the mind is pretty much a prisoner of the patterns of the cortex. Now, we're a prisoner of our brain. You may not believe that. Your brain is not a prisoner of your skull. Your skull is a prisoner of your brain. Because your whole body functions, all the bodily functions are controlled by the brain. Now, take, for example, this matter of anxiety. People have anxiety attacks. That's a common thing. Even more recently, it's been more precisely diagnosed. In the old days, they just say, well, I'll give you 60 seconds to get your act together and quit acting like a ninny. But that's not true. That's not when people say they have anxiety and they have fears or whatnot. But there's not all that mysterious. If I can get a little bit technical, the brain controls the glands of the body. Almost you know this already. The pituitary gland, which is in the center of the brain, the hypothalamus. The pituitary gland controls, it's called the master gland of the body, and it controls all the other glands. Which glands, it's the endocrine glands, which control our emotions, or our, controls our well-being. Now, for example, your capacity to handle stress is based upon the hormones secreted by the adrenal gland. The adrenaline stimulates the action of the respiratory system and the pulmonary system, that is, the heart and the breathing. Now, the heart is stimulated by the adrenal gland to get more blood to the needed area, because the bloodstream carries the energy in the form of sugar, of glucose, but it also needs the air, because the air carries the oxygen that burns up the sugar and creates the heat energy. That is, the heat energy is a result. Heat energy, or the energy of our body, is the result of the oxidation of glucose in the system. Now, when the adrenal gland, adrenaline is stimulated, the production of adrenaline is stimulated by the pituitary gland, ultimately, to increase the heart rate and increase the air intake so that the body gets an extra energy to cope with the situation, mentally or physically, either way, if it's a mental stress or a physical stress. Now, the interesting thing is this. The people who have anxiety attacks, and some of you know about this, people that have anxiety attacks are distressed because the heart rate increases, and there's shortness of breath, breathing increases, and they think they're having a heart attack. But the reason is that there seems to be no cause immediately of that action. See, now, I talked to a young woman this week about it, and she was in a lot of difficulty here. And so I said, well, now, if you went out and ran for a mile and all of this happened, you wouldn't think anything about it. I said, just figure that the body thinks you've been, your brain thinks you've been running. You haven't been. So it's miscued there, that's all. The action of some neurotransmitter in the brain has signaled in the same way that it would if there'd been an exertion. So what do you do? Well, you just figure the brain miscued and let it pass. Misfired. See that? You just thought, okay, the brain got confused and told you you were running and you're not running. That's no big deal. See? Now, you see, as I'm saying, what I'm getting across to you is that in a way we're prisoners of our brain, in that the brain, because of pattern. Now, where did this girl get this anxiety reaction? Hereditary. I asked her, and what I suspected was true. Her mother was the same way. I said, was your mother ever like this when she was younger? You knew her? Was she, did she have these things, these anxiety attacks? Yes, she did. And then I found out her father also had had them. See? Now, here's a girl, I don't know how old she is, 25 or something like that, who has this hereditary pattern. Nobody really knows exactly what takes place, but after all, I've talked to you a lot about neurotransmitters, that the brain gives it signals. And the body reacts according to the signal. That's why you can take a pill and things happen in your body. Because, you see, what we call a tranquilizer is really a brain fooler. Because it's amazing how easily the brain can get fooled. Yes, we're all fools. The older you get, the more you know we're all fools. But if you learn not to take yourself too seriously, you may survive. But the brain will only allow certain substances in it. There's a natural protection. It screens. The brain has a way of screening substances, so the bloodstream can only carry certain substances into the brain. Not everything you eat or everything substance you take into your body is, see, whereas the blood, you see, the blood passes through the whole body and into the brain, and things that you take in may affect other parts of the body, but they don't all get past that screening device in the brain. But what gets past it are substances that have the same building blocks. Thus, Enderol tablet, for example, and Enderol has the same building blocks as dopamine in the brain, so the brain thinks it's getting dopamine and it's getting Enderol. The same thing is true with morphine and some of the drugs that are a problem to us. The brain has received them because they're built like, now you see the brain, we have our own built-in painkillers, endorphins and enkephalins, and they're built up of certain structures, certain building blocks that are very, very similar to some of the tranquilizers that we take, like morphine, for example. So the brain thinks it's getting enkephalin and it's getting morphine, see? Now, the problem with that is then the body ceases producing its own substance and gets dependent upon the foreign substance, you see? That's where drug dependency comes. Now, all of these things show us the great complexity of the brain and show us that if you try to make a whole lot of sense out of it, you're going to be in trouble. In other words, we all think screwy. You know, we have a trouble. We have trouble really putting life together properly. And some people that think they're very well organized and everything they do seems to be well handled and so forth. And these people have a way of falling apart too. Perhaps you know people like that. They just seem like they're always so efficient and so well ordered and well organized. Everything is just so. And then they hit the sand trap somewhere and
they're, win.
Huh?
Win.
Well, they do. You just, a lot of times people put on a pretty good front, too. They like people to think they're efficient. If you could see some of these people on the off hours. I've often seen them on the off hours. When they come to me, it's when they've blown their stack. But I'm trying to give you a composite picture. And change is coming into the time, and the person themselves do not recognize any change at all, but people outside can see those changes. Now, the same thing is true with our feelings. Now, a person may say, well, I've never taken drugs and I never intend to, and that's well and good. But on the other hand, the brain produces effects in our system that are like drugs. Relationship to other people can have the same effect as drugs, for example. There's a chemical interaction, electrochemical interaction between persons and persons. You can get addicted to a person the same way you can get addicted to a drug. The brain doesn't distinguish between the electrochemical magnetism of vibrations. You know, for example, when I talk, it's an amazing thing when any of us talk that I can merely move my lips and my vocal organs here and you pick it up across the room. Why should you be able to do that? Well, it's because there are vibrations, there are impulses that travel across the room. Now, it doesn't have to be a spoken thing. These impulses can be given off by the individual in many different ways. You can get negative reactions, as you know this. Some people just hit you negatively, and you can get positive reactions from people. And the brain is affected by these things. There is not a clear-cut process of decision-making and reactions and interaction that we can really put a guilt trip on anybody for it. We tend to always blame people for the way they act, the things they do, and we have to take responsibility. That is true. There are consequences to our actions. But so much of what we do is based upon these physiological processes within us. Now, it's true that some of our decisions have brought us to that place, but on the other hand, given hereditary patterns, we might not have made those decisions, you see, given a different hereditary pattern. All right, now I've said a lot of things. Maybe most of it isn't even intelligible. I don't know. But the essence of what I'm trying to say is this. You can't depend upon your brain for your feelings and reactions to the circumstances in life, but you can depend upon your spirits when you have Christ in it. What I'm saying is your brain conjures up all kinds of things. Anxieties, worries, fears, distresses, disappointments, all these things are part of the natural human mental function. And you try your best to think differently, and you just can't. I mean, for example, let's say you've had a great emotional disappointment. And you say to yourself, now you just shouldn't feel this way. You know, like, now how many times, have you ever heard this thing from somebody when you, let's say a boyfriend or a girlfriend has run out on you or let you down. Has anybody ever said, don't worry about it, they're not worth it, you know? Did we hear that? Don't worry about him, he's just not worth it, not worth your time. Now, are you ever really able to follow that out and say, I never thought of that. Well, goodbye, Smedley, I never want to see you again. I'm so glad I left you. So glad you left me. Wish I never knew you. No, you don't do that. You still, and you've got some problem, and some well-meaning and sympathetic individual says, oh, don't worry about that, things pass, et cetera, et cetera. Does that cause you to quit worrying about it? No. How often are you really able to control your emotional feelings? How often? Now, maybe in time you get them under control. Sure. I've given you the illustration. I had couple of daughters. Two daughters. Anyway, I know something about the way, and I had a son. They're all still with me. All married. Now I have their mates with me. You know how it is. Some new boyfriend comes in the picture, and you get the name written all over everything. The notebook's covered with it, the wallpaper, everything. That name is there, you know. So then there's a blow-up a few months down the road or something, and then you have to buy a new notebook, put new wallpaper on it. But how long does it take? How long does it take for the new one to emerge? Not very long. These things pass. I make a little light of it, but, you know, even the tragic things pass. There are people that are inseparable, and they have a breakup, and they're apart now. In a few months' time or a year, in time, it passes. As they say, time heals all wounds. Not a bad thing. Very true. Usually, time heals these things. But you don't control it by just saying, oh, well, I'm not going to worry about this anymore. Now, I could come along with a religious thing here and say to you, well, that's just because you don't have faith. Just trust in Christ and you won't worry anymore. And that would be false. The Bible doesn't say that that's true. It says to trust in Christ, all right, but it never says you will never worry. Worry is, as I said last week, sometimes worry is a very important thing. You ought to worry if you're doing something that's out of order and you're afraid of the consequences, maybe you should worry. And like I said, if you've got bills that are coming due and you've already spent your income on other things, maybe you ought to worry a little bit. So next month you spend your income on the things you ought to spend it on. So worry is a wholesome thing in our world. But now I'm coming to the crux of the matter. You may think I'm a long time coming to it, but I'm trying to build a pretty solid base here. Crux of the matter is this. We go through this world with a great number of different kinds of problems, tragedies, joys, sorrows, great variety of experiences. We cope with some and we don't cope with others very well. We handle some things, we don't handle other things. But we live it out. See, we're just living out our life on the earth. And we are variously happy and sad and joyful and sorrowful and whatnot. Some people run the range of emotions from ecstasy to misery or agony rather regularly. But people, there again, you've got an hereditary factor for the most part. Some people are low-key and some people are high-key, you see. The low-key person is probably never too ecstatic, but never too depressed. But there are people that get just jubilant and ecstatic with some things, and the person that has the capacity to get very ecstatic about things normally has the capacity to get very depressed about things. The psychologists love a manic depressive because it's not all that easy to tell him he's not right about it, and he can always give you a pill and appear to have handled your problem. But people, normal people, can run quite a range of emotion from misery to ecstasy depending upon their hereditary pattern. And some people just aren't that expressive outwardly, and some people are expressive outwardly, you see. Now, people that make a religious thing out of it make a mistake. They don't understand the human psyche. People that enjoy meetings where everything is very loose and very emotional, maybe that's the way they're built. If they like that, that's all right with me. I never object to people having those kinds of meetings. I just don't want them to tell me I have to have that kind of thing. We have these ranges of emotions, and we don't control them a whole lot. But the thing that sustains us through all of this, and the thing that is constant, is the spirit within us. Whatever your human psyche is, however you react or interact or whatever is going on in your life, you can be sure that if you've taken Christ into your spirit, He is saved. Don't use your brain as the key or your thought patterns as the key to the reality of your well-being, you see. Feel the way you have to. And I have to say that there are a lot of reasons to control ourselves. We don't control our emotions, but we can control our actions. To control your emotions may be to be phony. You see, you can't, if you deny, whatever, if you deny your emotions, you may just be putting on a facade. You can't deny your emotions. And I've said in this book, you can't help how you feel, but you can help how you deal with how you feel. You can hate somebody, you don't have to go out and kill them. See? You might feel like it, but you don't have to do it. Well, a lot of ways we can illustrate that. You can feel things, but you ought to be careful how you act. And that's where you have responsibility. You're not responsible for how you feel. You're responsible for the actions that arise out of how you feel. You see that? You can control your actions, even if you can't control your feelings. So I'm not saying here today, tonight, that you can just go out and live any way you please and it doesn't matter. It does matter. I'm not saying we're not accountable for our actions. We are accountable for our actions. But as far as our confidence is concerned in life, we trust Christ and not how we feel about Christ. We trust His power to help and not how we feel about His power to help. See? We may feel discouraged about Christ, about our faith, about life, but that doesn't mean Christ runs away from us. See? He does not leave us just because we don't feel well about things, or do, you know, just because of our fluctuating lives. It's difficult to really put this into words, but I trust that we can get across this idea that when you take Christ into your spirit, it is His power within us that gives us the capacity to be sustained in this world, in spite of all of its ups and downs. You can look at people around you in trouble and not feel that God is unjust just because they have trouble. you can look at your own trouble and not feel that God is unjust because of your trouble. He simply doesn't go about reversing the laws of nature to put everybody in a little capsule. We do suffer the outrageous fortunes of this life, as Hamlet said. Slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. We suffer those things. Willy-nilly almost, as some people have tragedies and others don't seem to have them, or the same kind of tragedy. But in all of this, Christ sustains us. And now I launched off from a given point here, and I'm going to come back to the highway before I leave you, so I don't leave you wandering in the woods. I've said that there are many, many things that the Bible teaches us that are pretty commonly accepted within the body of believers. One of those things is that Christ does interact with the people of earth. But one of the areas in which there's a lot of confusion and variant teaching is the degree to which God makes the world nice for people. And I was just discussing that whole point and saying that the facts of surrounding reality indicate to us that whatever high visionary ideals some people have, the general nature of life is that we have a struggle to survive on the earth. And that waving a magic wand is not going to suddenly make everything nice for us, as some people seem to teach. But I've said there's no support for that in the Scripture, that God is supposed to take away all the hurts and all the sorrows and all the ills of life and make it nice for you. Well, I went far more deeply into this thing than I intended to go. I was just going to give some introductory comments and proceed with another line of things, but I got off into that great morass of the human brain. But I think it should be helpful to remember it's the power of Christ in our spirit that is what sustains us and not our capacity to handle life properly. So some things you handle well and some you don't. But don't worry about it. The Lord's still with you. And again, the proof that here, evidence he's with you, is that you come to a place like this and are concerned to find out about your life, to know the truth. If you didn't have, if you didn't care about God, you'd just go out and do whatever you wanted to and not worry about it.